I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. James Hogan joins me again. He's written a new book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. It's a timely book given the state of debate on issues big and small in the political arena here and abroad. The presidential race in the United States is surely on everyone's mind as to the coarseness of the leading Republican contender, Donald Trump. So is this a new phenomenon, or is this something that's been going on ever since people gathered in the town square to debate and discuss? It certainly goes back to the debate on climate change, something that Mr. Hogan knows much about, having created the website DeSmog Blog. He talks in the book about the challenges faced in the discussions about the environment in recent years. In this book, he talks to a lot of prominent thinkers who share their experiences and perhaps their remedies. I'll ask Jim about those and more. James Hogan is the president of Hogan & Associates, a public relations firm here in Vancouver. He's also the chair of the David Suzuki Foundation Board. His previous books include Do the Right Thing and Climate Cover-Up, which he was last on this program with in 2009. This new book is published by New Society and written with Grania Litwin. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, James Hogan. Mr. Hogan, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So is the public discourse at the moment where we are in this last little bit, is it at its coarsest?
Well, I would like to say, yes, I hope this is as far as it's going to go, but I'm not optimistic about that. I think that, you know, I'd like to just start by saying that civility is a problem in public discourse. You know, respect for the views of other people, of course, you know, it's something we learned about, I'm assuming, in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a problem. But I'm worried about something that I think is worse than that. And it's more of a kind of a toxic pollution that seems to have invaded the public square. I mean, I think that just like you can pollute the natural environment, you can pollute public conversations, and there are consequences. When things look so extreme, when positions are extreme, what happens is people think that issues are unsolvable. People tend to sort of turn away from highly toxic public conversations, except the people who are kind of vigorously involved in them. But the general public as a whole turns off when the level of pollution in public discourse goes up, and for sure it is increasing.
So when you talk about civility and the lack of it, and not only in the public square, but in public debate, someone might say, well, you know, even at the grocery store or on the bus or you know, where people... young people, not even young people these days, but I mean, you think of road rage on the streets and the sort, people are less than civil.
Yeah.
And so if it's a symptom of where society's at, what's the cause of that, do you think?
I think people are afraid of a lot of the big issues that we have stalking us. Everything from, you know, the price of housing, to income inequality, to climate change, to a whole range of environmental and social justice issues. And they're concerned about our inability, it seems, to be able to do anything about these problems. I think people are frightened by these issues, and I think we should be concerned about them. But I think people are also despairing of our inability to be able to do something about problems that are sitting right in front of us. Levels of mistrust and public confidence in government and industry and institutions confidence is low, mistrust is high, polarization is very high. And I think all of that kind of combines to create a quality of public discourse that's very low. And I think that kind of undermines people's confidence and makes people even more nervous about the world that we live in.
And then they just automatically turn off, they become apathetic, and they don't connect, they don't engage.
Yeah, and we can't solve problems. And so we have these problems that we can't do anything about, and we need to, and people know we need to. And so I think, in my view, the cause of it is, is not just the lack of civility. It's you see it with Donald Trump in the most kind of blatant way. This ad hominem attacks on that sort of sidestep the actual argument and go right to kind of beyond name calling, but go right to kind of discrediting and criticizing the intentions and the sort of moral fiber of people who disagree with you. And so we saw that in the last election, and before that in 2012 with the Foreign Funded Radicals campaign here, where you had the federal government and the oil and gas industry attacking communities that didn't want pipelines. And it wasn't enough to just say, we need these pipelines, you think we don't, and actually get in an argument about it. They had to take it down this road of these ad hominem attacks, where you're basically accusing people who don't want tankers and pipelines in their community of being un-Canadian or being funded by groups from the United States. And this type of, there's something worse than dishonest here, because I think it pollutes public conversation to the point where you're essentially silencing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, take the climate change issue for a sec here. I mean, if you have the science on your side, one would think that you would automatically win the day. But the other side, who opposes whatever change, whatever you feel, say, on climate change, will have a different set of facts or their own set of facts. And right off the bat, the two people debating are on different pages, and it just devolves from there.
Right. Yes. So I see this as a problem coming from, you know, all sides of the public square. I don't just see this as, you know, an industry. There's examples of it going, you know, back in 2012 when there was this broad effort, this widespread effort by Ethical Oil and the conservative government to discredit communities that were opposing pipelines. At the same time, you had environmental groups or certain environmentalists accusing companies that are working in the oil sands of crimes against humanity and, you know, calling oil from the oil sands heroin and so on. So it comes from both sides, the sort of demonization of people who disagree with you, and it just reinforces the public perception that we're not going to be able to solve these problems.
So the argument Donald Trump will make, he has made it in terms of his getting to the Republican nomination, and he'll continue to make it throughout the campaign, is that he's brought new people to the process, that a lot of people who otherwise would not have voted in those Republican primaries voted because of him. And so I mean, we'll take that at face value and assume that a lot of these people are attracted to Trump's message and the sort of style of politics that Trump is espousing. Does that mean then that they're wrong, that they shouldn't participate, people who hold views that are, say, you know, not necessarily ones that have been in the public square heretofore, they ought not to participate?
I think, for me, I think there is a question of how you do it. And I think there's a kind of a values consideration when you look at Donald Trump and the methods that he uses to kind of just circumvent any kind of reasoned debate at all and just attack somebody as lying Hillary or crooked Hillary or, you know, accusing...
Lying Ted and little Marco,
yeah. So what is that? You know, and the closer you look at it, what you see is that there's not a democratic argument going on. It's basically just demagoguery and the appeal to fear and anger and bigotry and racism and all those ugly things that go along with it. So stirring up hatred and fear is anti-democratic, and it pollutes public conversations because it eliminates the voices of certain groups. So you don't have a right to participate in your democracy if you're a Muslim, or if you're Mexican, you're kind of, you know, frowned upon. If you're, you know, even if you're a judge. You know, so there's these crazy, I think a lot of people mistakenly look at Donald Trump and think he's just kind of a loose cannon. I don't think that's the case at all. I think he's using tried and true historic methods of propaganda, that it's used to stir up fear, hatred, and it totally ignores, maybe not totally, but it mainly ignores the arguments of substance.
So maybe I'm just too optimistic, Jim, and hopeful that the American people will see through this and know that he's just full of it.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right. And I can't imagine that they won't. But it's still unfortunate. I mean, if you look here, you know, we've had a history in Canada of being able to feel quite smug when we look south of the border at the kind of craziness that goes on down there.
Yeah.
But if you look at the last election, we had the Prime Minister talking about, what was it he called, old stock Canadian.
Yeah.
You know, that is like dog whistle racism. We had this whole kneecap issue. We had this, the debate over immigration. We had this, I don't know if you recall that, I don't know if you've even actually seen the picture, but the picture actually is much more powerful than the description. But here you have a minister or a couple of ministers standing at a press conference with this huge banner about the Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act,
right.
Which is essentially a wedge, you know, a semi-racist strategy to basically build their base. And essentially, there's no protections that don't already exist that were enabled by that legislation. And so this type of narrative where you're sort of appealing to people's prejudice and undermining the rights, the democratic rights to free speech and to be heard of certain groups, this is the kind of pollution that I'm talking about. And you see it around a whole range of issues. Certainly you can see it in the United States around the election, but you can also see it now around gun control.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it around climate change. It's been going on around climate change and energy in Canada for well over a decade. Highly polarized ways of trying to discredit people who disagree with you.
In the book, you also look at how our brains work, and you talk to some people who talk about, say, the psychology that goes on in our heads. I mean, are we predisposed to being misled, do you think?
Yes. I think in some cases we want to be misled.
Why?
Well, it's a there was two fellows that I interviewed, Jonathan Haidt and Dan Kahan. Jonathan Haidt is a moral psychologist, and he says that humans are designed by evolution to unite into teams, to divide those teams against other teams, and then be blinded by the truth. That there's a kind of what he calls a groupish righteousness, that we get caught in our own kind of moral matrix, and we get ourselves into a situation where if we have a mistaken belief about something and evidence comes along to point that out, that we don't change our beliefs, we actually manipulate the evidence to support our false beliefs. So tribalism has been a really good thing. You know, it sure helped the first humans on the plains of Africa to be able to unite into tribes and communities. But at the same time, what happens is that you can have this kind of cultural way that you look at the world manipulating your own reasoning so that it's motivated. The reasoning becomes motivated to adjust information to reinforce the cultural beliefs, even when they're false, of your group. And so that is the research that has been done by Dan Kahan at Yale shows that it doesn't even really matter how well educated you are, and it doesn't even matter how science literate you are. When they look at climate change, there's no difference between the basic science literacy of climate change deniers and people who recognize that climate change is a problem. Hmm. So these forces of sort of self-manipulation and this interest in kind of fooling ourselves is very powerful.
Yeah. So you're someone in the PR business, the spin business, if you will. Have you thought about how you go about your work? I mean, I'm sure you're not guilty of some of the tactics that you talk about in the book, but I mean, does it change how you go about advising some of your clients in terms of how they're perceived in the public?
It does, and I have to admit that I've learned a lot. I've been in the business a long time, and you know, I've been sort of a thoughtful participant in the business, and I've always thought that, you know, most of the time you get the reputation you deserve. So if you want a good reputation, then you better work hard at deserving it, and that spin has its limits. And I think most people I know in the public relations business know that. When you get involved in some of the more difficult issues, like the climate change issue and what that means to resource-based economies, and you know, or the tobacco industry or the gun industry or these other much more difficult areas, there is a tendency for people like me to think that the facts matter more than they actually do. One of the things that I've learned, and I have changed the way I give advice to clients now, is that facts don't change minds the way we think they do.
Mm.
They don't have the power that we think they do. And often, when someone is kind of way out there with certain kinds of thinking on whatever issue, it's not because they're stupid, and it's not because they're an idiot. It's not because they need the facts and they don't have them. They don't understand. It's because they have a different belief system, and they see the world in a totally different way. And the more you confront it, often the worse it gets. So that's a very different kind of, like, how do you communicate in a situation like that is much more challenging than just trying to make sure you're articulate.
Yeah, because I mean, if you just debate the person or the whatever organization that is, it just heightens the rhetoric, and nothing happens, I guess, right?
Yeah, and one of the women I interviewed, her name is Carol Tavris.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote a book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not by Me, and she her book is on self-justification, and people and this thing called cognitive dissonance. It's sort of the pain we feel when we realize that we're not the fair-minded, smart, honest person that we think we are. And we realize we've done something stupid or dishonest or whatever. People don't like to admit they made mistakes.
Right.
And so she says they get involved in something she calls self-justification. And she says that these psychological forces of self-justification, this mechanism, is every bit as powerful as thirst and hunger, that they are very powerful psychological forces. Facts don't do very well when they're bumping up against that problem. And that's why, you know, if you have a climate change denier uncle who you always get in, like, these battles with at, you know, Christmas dinner,
right,
that's what's happening.
Yeah, you rarely hear someone apologize. You rarely hear someone say, "Oh yeah, no, you made a good point. I've changed
exactly.
my mind." Right? Yeah.
Exactly, especially publicly.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
In public, we're even less likely to say, "Okay, yeah, all right. I guess you were right about that." It just doesn't happen. I don't. The last time I can't remember hearing Donald Trump say he was wrong about anything for all the time I've been watching him.
Right. Someone you talked to in the book who I had on the show recently, and I've long admired her, is Ann Giardini. And she, in her part of the book, talks about how laments just where we are in the state of the discourse, but offers a solution in terms of empathy. And I think we could use a little bit of that, couldn't we?
Yes. And this is real and a really important lesson, because what she's talking about with empathy is listening, having a kind of, it's something that the Dalai Lama said to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right at the very end of the interview with the Dalai Lama, he pointed his finger at my forehead and he said, like to think the Western mind is more sophisticated, but I think the Tibetan heart might be stronger. Maybe if we take the Tibetan heart, the Eastern heart, with the Western mind, we can start to fix some of these problems. And I think that what he's talking about there is the kind of empathy or warm-heartedness that we need to actually communicate on these issues. And part of what happens, I think, when we're more empathetic is we start to understand that we can be the person in the conversation, in the disagreement, who's biased. There's a good likelihood it could be us, just as likely maybe in some cases as the other person. It's easier for us to see somebody else as biased than it is to see ourselves as biased.
Right.
But it's a good thing, I think, as just a human habit to remember that you could unknowingly be under the influence of bias. And because of that, it's a good idea to be sensitive in the way Anne talks about that in her book when she was meeting with First Nations.
Yeah.
Be sensitive to how people are feeling. It makes you a better listener, and it makes it more likely that they'll listen to you.
So the American election is in November, and we're bracing ourselves for the onslaught of attacks from both sides. And in this province, we've got an election in less than a year, and the rhetoric's going to be quite high with regards to that. What tips have you got for the electorate out there, the voter, in terms of, say, girding themselves from helping them sort through fact and the bullshit, if you will?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I would look for, and one in particular is how much someone actually seems to enjoy and rely on demolishing the character and the intentions and the credibility of the other person.
Mm.
So, you see the extreme example in the United States with name calling, which is not anything you usually see done in such a blatant way in Canada, but you see some of it up here. You know, the foreign funded radicals, the old stock Canadian, there is some name calling that and some ad hominem attacks that are going on there. And in Canada, in BC, there's something recently I heard about the forces of no. These types of polarization, that is a style, I think, a style of public discourse that is really toxic in the long term. And I think you're seeing it in the United States, where you have decade after decade of the Republican Party holding these really kind of crazy positions on a variety of issues, like climate change isn't the problem, and similar types of positions on gun control that, giving people more guns makes everybody safer. These things that are sort of, that you couldn't actually, you couldn't make an argument to support that, and so instead what they do is they polarize their way through the election. Well, what ends up happening is that you set a norm, and you pollute public discourse in a way. So the people that you have stirred up and made fearful and angry, they're still there after the election, and you got to deal with them. And as time goes on, the more fact-free your narrative was, the more you actually avoided the argument, the more you have this collective unconsciousness or this collective obliviousness to evidence. And so you have to deal with that. And if you continue to do it election after election, you get yourself into a lot of trouble. And that's what I call the polluted public square. So for me personally, I would watch out for that. Try not to do it myself, but also be very cautious of someone else you see doing it.
So at the end of the day, Jim, are you hopeful that it'll get better, that we will have high-minded discussions rather than, say, just yelling at each other? I mean, about a few days ago on Broadway, they were giving out the Tony Awards, and the best musical of the year, and it's the big hit for the last year or so around the United States, is Hamilton. And it's a musical about Alexander Hamilton, and the challenges that he had in his day, trying to you know, as one of the founding fathers. And you know, I think back to you know, the that time in America, at America's founding, and the rhetoric was quite high. It was a time of fear, and yet here we are today with similar challenges, I suppose. I mean, it's a lot different. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not challenging each other to duels and the sort. But so where do you see this? How do you see this ending? I mean, is there light at the end of the tunnel, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are very complicated creatures, humans, and there's like lots of good in us and also lots of bad in us. And I, you know, when I think back 25 years ago, I had a partner in my PR company who came into my office and told me he was gay. And I remember thinking, okay, you know, if there's any of our clients who have an issue with that, well, they can go find another PR firm. And it's not an issue with me. But I, you know, afterwards I was thinking about how this was such a big moment for this fellow to come in and talk to me about that. And this is this guy's like an athletic, macho kind of guy. And now I look at the way the world is, and he remains a very good friend of mine, and now he doesn't have to have that conversation with anyone. The world is a different place. He can get married. He you know, his rights are not lesser than mine, and he's not looked down on by most people. And so we can make these amazing changes. When you look at the changes that took place in you know, same-sex marriage over the last, it's not just over the last couple of decades, it's over the last 5 years. And, you know, what change we can make. And psychology, one of the things that psychology teaches us is we can change. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to become more aware of our own role in being a barrier to communications and empathetic, in particular, empathetic communications. And I think, you know, we need to get as good at finding common ground as we are at polarizing.
Jim, it's nice talking again. This is an engaging book. Good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
The book is called I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. New Society is its publisher. James Hogan, who wrote the book with Grania Litwin, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.